So what we've been trying to do in a nutshell is trying to turn medicine back on itself to where it was a number of centuries ago, which is sounds a bit regressive, but at a time when people relied less on knowledge and more on the art of medicine and thinking about your thinking. And in the earlier days of medicine, as you probably know, philosophy and logic and psychology were very much more a part of what a physician did because they didn't have the fund of knowledge that we have now. We now have plenty of access to lots of knowledge, but we don't have as good access to how to think about that knowledge that we do have.
Welcome to Flourishing in Medicine from Surviving to Thriving. I'm your host, Dr. Mick Krasner, and this podcast is produced by MPRO, a medical professional liability insurance carrier headquartered in the New York City area. And they are committed through a number of peer support offerings to really supporting the physicians that they protect. Today, I'm excited to share with you my conversation with Dr. Pat Cross-Carey, an emergency medicine specialist and professor at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada. He trained initially as an experimental psychologist before entering medicine, and he's become arguably one of the world's foremost experts in safety in emergency medicine and diagnostic errors. He directs the critical thinking program within the Division of Medical Education at Dalhousie, and he continues to study and write about clinical decision-making, diagnostic failure, and the role of cognitive and affective bias, with more recent work focusing on how to mitigate cognitive bias and its impact. During this fascinating conversation, Pat shares his unique path to medicine, stemming from a background in psychology that instilled a focus on critical thinking and cognitive biases, and the discipline to study medicine, which was, we found out, informed by his brief rowing career, during which he, as a member of the Canadian national team, competed in the Olympic Games. He delves into specific biases affecting medical decision-making, such as emotional, affective, anchoring, and search-satisficing biases, stressing the need to mitigate these biases for accurate diagnosis. Furthermore, he explores the impact of cognitive load and decision fatigue on physician well-being, advocating for a reconsideration of critical thinking's role in modern medical practice to ensure optimal performance and professional satisfaction. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Pat Cross-Carey. Welcome, Dr. Cross-Carey, to Flourishing in Medicine from Surviving to Thriving, where we really are interested in exploring all the different ways in which we can, as health professionals, especially physicians, improve our sense of effectiveness, meaning, and well-being in our work. And what I'd like to start with is a little bit about you, your story. It's interesting how people come to the work that they do, especially in medicine. Sometimes there's common threads that have to do with early experience. Sometimes these are developmental experiences that happen over one's education and work life, etc. So for you, if you could just kind of walk us through what were some of the early influences and ideas that has led you to this really interesting career in both medicine and research.
Yeah, thanks for the invite, Mike, to be here. My journey has been slightly different, I guess, from the average clinician doctor, in the sense that I turned to medicine fairly late in life. That was age 16 instead of age 14, because in England, where I grew up, you had to sort of commit yourself early, which meant that you had to get into a science track, do all the basic sciences, physics, chemistry, zoology. And yet all of my background was in languages and history and art. So I made this transformation, but didn't make it very well. So by the time the qualifying exams came from medical school, I didn't have good enough grades in the sciences, having been at it only a couple of years. And I had to spend some extra time trying to bring those grades up. But in the meantime, got offered a place at the university in Scotland to do psychology. That wasn't entirely the obvious default for medicine, but in my case, it was very fortuitous. So I did an undergraduate degree in psychology and thought, well, I'll be a psychologist, I think, for the rest of my life. But then my earlier leanings got back to me and I decided to go into medicine. So I had finished my training as a psychologist, my undergraduate and postgraduate training, and so came to medicine a little bit later than the average person. And of course, medicine was what I always wanted to do. So I kind of put all the solid psychology behind me. But when I got into, and during undergraduate training, that was fine. But when I got into medical practice, I started to notice that one of the most important things that I seemed to do each day was make decisions and think. It wasn't the background of medical knowledge that, you know, I was concerned about. All of that was fine. But what I seemed to spend most of my time doing was thinking about how I was thinking. And I guess that is outside of the usual trajectory. Most people in medicine accept what they're taught and they go with it and they follow their careers through in their various specialty training. But in my case, I couldn't get away from how important it was to think about what you were thinking. And that sounds a little bit sort of basic and maybe a little even circular. But what I'm getting at is that we, many of us just follow the habits and the drives and do the obvious things for the culture that we're in. And here was I, trained psychologist, I'd actually gone through to complete my PhD and postdoctoral work in psychology. And I was suddenly thinking, this is not my environment. It's an environment I really like, but I think there's something missing. I don't think we're thinking enough about what we're doing. So this got me into various kinds of trouble. But after a while, people began to accept that there was an opening here for people to consider how they were thinking when they were approaching a problem. Now, there was no question that you absolutely needed medical knowledge. There's no substitute for medical knowledge. And at that time, there were very few shortcuts. There are shortcuts now. People can immediately go to up-to-date programs and all kinds of IT backup to get information very quickly. But you couldn't so much earlier on. So that was really it. I started to focus in and notice that people, not just in medicine, but in pretty well every walk of life, people are vulnerable to these kind of flaws in their thinking. We all tend to make, whether you're an engineer or a lawyer or a construction worker or a mechanic, we all tend to make certain assumptions about the environment. And most of us have a tendency to be overconfident in what we can deal with, not so much what we know, but and this trait is encouraged in medicine. People want you to be confident and assured and reassuring and a good source of knowledge and so on. So we ended up focusing a lot on the main things that distort our thinking, and those were cognitive biases. And these are pervasive everywhere you go where there is human activity, and that includes deep space. We were recently approached by NASA to offer some insights into what kinds of challenges in decision making might happen if you were on a mission to Mars, for example, and what sorts of things couldn't you take for granted. And I don't know if you saw the movie The Martian, but he got into some serious trouble and got out of it by some pretty good thinking. So what we've been trying to do in a nutshell is trying to turn medicine back on itself to where it was a number of centuries ago, which is sounds a bit regressive, but at a time when people relied less on knowledge and more on the art of medicine and thinking about your thinking. And in the earlier days of medicine, as you probably know, philosophy and logic and psychology were very much more a part of what a physician did because they didn't have the fund of knowledge that we have now. We now have plenty of access to lots of knowledge, but we don't have as good access to how to think about that knowledge that we do have.
That's great. Thank you. That is a really good walkthrough how you got to where you are. Although I still am curious, and maybe we can step back. We're going to get deeper into the cognition and cognitive bias, and it was fortuitous indeed, although you say it got you into all sorts of trouble. I think trouble in a good way for you and for us too, as a profession. But you still said something about you always wanted to do medicine. And I want to get a little bit underneath that. Why? Because I think this is a driving force for many, 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 probably most of our colleagues. And I think to combine that deep desire to really understand that, also knowing that, well, if you really, really want to do this and there's this love that you're moving toward, we do have to think about how we approach it in terms of our cognition. So back to square one, why did you really want to do this medicine piece? And then maybe can you just thread in a little bit, because I'll bet there's something there. I'm wondering if there's something there about your athletic experiences, whether that informed any of those desires as well.
It didn't at that time, Nick, but later on it did. And in the beginning, I was, I think, trying to get at this interest in medicine. It really was a strong vocation with me that I wasn't able to realize at that time because of the lack of science background and so on. But I lived in a small town on the English coast near Dover, and a local hero in our community was the physician, because as shipping frequently got into trouble in the channel, in the English Channel, it's one of the busiest shipping routes in the world, and there were lifeboats all along the English coast. These were extremely well-equipped vessels that could survive virtually any sea conditions, and the doctor would be called out on some of these rescue missions, and we would all hear it in the town because the alert for shipping in distress was two rockets that would be fired from the town center. And if a third rocket was fired, it meant that they wanted the doctor to come down to the lifeboat as well. So everybody used to sort of hang on for the third rocket. And then we all knew that the doctor was going. And the doctor who did do that became very famous in England. He was called the sea surgeon, but he did some heroic things. And I think, like anything else in any community, if you have somebody who's perceived as a local hero, then young, especially in my case, if he was a male and a hero that I could relate to directly, then that was a good direction to go. So that really was my incentive, I think, was this famous local doctor that I thought we all looked up to. And to get to the other point that you mentioned, which was sport, the other thing we did in that little town was we rowed on the sea. And each town down the coast of the English Channel had these rowing clubs. And they weren't rowing like you think of it, you know, Harvard and Yale and Princeton and these beautiful eight on beautifully calm lakes. These were rough, tough rowing boats on the English Channel. And the boats would frequently fill up with water and you'd sink and you'd have to swim to shore and bail them out. And you couldn't have an eight on the water because it would be too fragile. So when I got to university, I suddenly found that I had access to these beautiful racing boats that you could. This was real finesse compared with what we used to do on the English Channel. And I got more and more involved in rowing and then eventually ended up on the national team in Canada and went to the Olympics. So I think what that did was, above anything else, I mean, if medicine itself wasn't enough of a discipline that one had to learn to follow, as you know, there's no shortcuts in medicine. You have to put in the work, you have to put in the hours, and it's a highly disciplined profession. And on top of this, I had this rigorous training in rowing on the national team that went far beyond anything I did But when I first got into it, if I knew what I was going to get into, I probably wouldn't have done it. But I rode at that level for 2 or 3 years. That was as far as I wanted to go with that. It was cutting into my time a lot. So those are just putting those two things together. It's funny because I haven't really tried to do that before. This is a first.
I think that there is what you say is that the discipline that one has to apply, perhaps that also influenced in some ways the discipline you applied to experimental psychology and then also coming back to medicine and really focusing on that. I want to share with you a quote I found. It's from an interview you had a number of years ago, and as a way of kind of getting back into this discussion about cognition, and it's goes the following: I really wasn't aware of the issue until I became head of an emergency department. It says something about the covert nature of error in medicine that I really wasn't aware of what was going on in the department until suddenly everything started coming across my desk. What struck me was that I never ran into a case where a mistake was malevolent or egregious in any way. The errors always involve well-intentioned efforts by hardworking people, but these people were working with imperfect systems and flogged cognition. So just that as an entree into, you know, discussion about this growing recognition and how you began to think about how we think.
Yeah, that's a really important topic. Part of the problem in medicine, I mean, I'm not picking holes in medicine, but medicine is an imperfect science in a number of ways. And in fact, you know, it's described by the people in it as both an art and a science. So that we've always kind of had a foot. Medicine has had a foot in one camp, the sort of artistic moiety. And yet, just from our background, primarily medicine has a major foot in science. And in some ways, it's kind of struggled a bit to become a fully fledged science. I remember when I was a psychologist, experimental psychologist, I was working in a research team. And people used to talk about research and they'd say, I saw this paper the other day that was quite interesting, but it was from medicine. There was a but in there. It was from medicine. And why was the but there? It was because people didn't accept in rigorous science, which experimental psychology is, and so it is in physics and chemistry and the other major sciences, there is a very hard objective line that you follow of evidence. In medicine, we don't have that luxury. In a way, it's a luxury, and at the same time, it's a hindrance. But it's this notion of dealing with the sort of soft underbelly of what it is that we do. Because of the uncertainty in medicine, the fact that you never can know everything in the way that a physicist can when they're studying the relationships between physical matter, we have this big variable in there called people, and people are capable of a lot of kind of noise in the system. In psychophysics, it would be called noise, that these psychologists talk about separating the signal from the noise. And it seemed to me in emergency medicine that that's a lot of the time what we were doing. I used to tell medical students, every patient who walks in that door into the emergency department has got a critical signal in them. There's a reason that they're there. And our job is to separate away that signal from the noise, the contaminating noise that it has, you know. So, for example, if you had a drug user who came into emergency and was complaining of a headache, often you would hear comments on the side from people saying that they were looking for drugs. There really wasn't anything wrong with them. They're here all the time. They're frequent flyers and so on. And that's all noise. But the critical signal that you couldn't afford to miss was that that person who was a victim of addiction could carry some very important signal. They were just as vulnerable to a whole range of diseases as the rest of the population. And in fact, they were more vulnerable in certain ways than others. The only full arrests I ever saw in young people in emergency were cocaine users, and you couldn't afford to be diverted by the noise. The signal was there, and you had to make sure that you took care of the signal and you weren't getting distracted by noise.
It gives a very practical example of what we're talking about. I'd like to share a brief story of mine and have you look at it through the lens of cognitive and affective bias and whatever other kind of categories of bias. And then if you could, it'd be interesting to hear kind of how you would analyze this. So this happened to my daughter. I have three children, but the two older ones, one was 6 and my daughter was 4, the son and daughter playing. I'm at work. She hurts herself. They're wrestling on the ground. My wife takes them into the pediatrician. The pediatrician sends a medical student in, does a wonderful history, brings the doctor in. And as the medical student is beginning to recount the history to the physician says, stop right there. You don't have to say anything. I know exactly what it is. It's a nursemaid's elbow. It's classic. And so my wife, not knowing what that meant, says, well, what's that? And she said, well, you know, at that age of a child, if you kind of yank on their wrist and pull their arm, one of the bones comes out of a little fibrous annulus. And it's very painful. But the really cool thing about it is it's super easy to fix. And it's classic because that's how she's holding her elbow. And all you have to do is do here, I'll show you. And she puts her through this maneuver and my daughter screams and then she gives her a minute or two and does it again. And then she again doesn't like it and holds her arm just the same way. And she says, listen, let's get an x-ray, but I'm sure it's fine. It's a x-ray. The x-ray is normal. And she sends her home with my wife and says, you know, this is just, you know, it's just all the emotion of coming to the doctor and all this happening. She'll be fine. You'll see. You'll get home. And in a few minutes, she's going to be fine when she's home in her own setting away from us. And as they're walking out, it's not so funny. And this is a physician I have a lot of respect for, even still. The physician turns to the medical student and says, you know, the doctor's children, you know, there's always a little bit more going on there, kind of in a snarky kind of way. And I get home a little early and I see her. This is an hour later. She's still holding her arm the same. And I say, you know, honey, where does it hurt? And she points to her wrist. I call the radiologist up and the radiologist says the elbow x-ray is normal, which it would be in the nursemaid's elbow, of course. And I say, well, can I bring her in? And sure enough, she had a little buckle fracture of the wrist. No big deal, but really a source of the pain. So given that story, walk us through some of those cognitive and affective biases, which may be kind of the example being the comment the physician makes toward the student about us. If you could, that would be really interesting for you to walk us through those multiple biases there, of course.
Okay, so I'd say a major bias in there to start off with is an injured child, which affects us all, whoever we are. And it's a kind of widespread emotional polarization. You know, when you see a child in distress, your immediate reaction is to try and help, try to solve the problem, and also to be reassuring and comforting to the child. And I'm sure that the attending physician was as much a victim of that as the medical student was. And in the teaching context, the attending physician has a tendency sometimes, depends how strong their ego is, I guess, but a tendency to want to appear knowledgeable. And I've seen all this before and sort of teaches the medical student that, you know, inadvertently, a bit of experience is the key factor here, and that he recognizes a common injury in children. That's all very well, but unfortunately, he is kind of reacting in a way to the noise that we talked about earlier. He's distracted by a young child in distress, and he's also got this intermediate thing that the medical student has examined the child. And perhaps his ego is caught up in this a bit, and he wants to demonstrate that he's seen this before and he knows what to do. So trying to recognize sources of noise is really critical. And also being able to say to yourself, to detach yourself from the situation and say, what else could this be? Is there anything I could be missing? That should be almost a reflexive, as I'll say strategy, but it almost should be a reflexive habit that physicians have when they think they know what's going on. So there's an element there certainly of overconfidence. And if you are overconfident, you're dangerous, and you must be willing to get out of the particular bias. Here is an anchor. It's called anchoring and adjustment. Making anchors is okay. If the child comes in with a painful arm and you immediately focus on the arm, that's anchoring. but it's appropriate. You don't start checking their neck and checking their legs. You anchor into the appropriate area. But your adjustment should be to any new information that's come on. And there is a rule in pediatrics that for any injury, you examine the joint above and below. That is almost a mantra among emergency physicians. So the first thing that the experienced physician should be thinking is, if the complaint seems to be the elbow, I need to examine the wrist and I need to examine the shoulder. And unless that is done, then you get into these traps with anchoring. And the other bias there is search satisficing, where when you approach the patient, as we said earlier, you're trying to distinguish the signal from the noise. And sometimes when you think you've found the signal, you satisfy yourself too quickly. Search satisficing is a bias that seems to be passed down genetically. If you think of our ancient ancestors, in our cavemen ancestors, you know, when the light was going down, say on a day, that there were a couple of things that they had to satisfy themselves about, that they would have shelter for the night and that it would be safe. And Herbert Simon, who won a Nobel Prize in this area, decision making, talks about this bias of search satisficing, which means as soon as you think you've got a good shelter, and as soon as you think it's safe, and as soon as you've protected your wife or partner and children, then you can satisfy yourself that you've accomplished what needs to be done. In this case, if you translate it into medicine, what search satisficing does sometimes is it pushes you into an early kind of stopping point. The psychologists talk about this a lot, that when we're going through these sort of how do people make decisions and the decision trees that are built around decisions, each of these little branches is a potential stopping point. And you have to be careful that you don't settle for a stopping point too soon. So this attending physician in your daughter's case settled on the elbow too quickly, because it, nursemaid's elbow is a common condition in children when they're playing and wrestling and being thrown around. So settled on this very quickly. So that was search satisficing, anchoring in the first place, then search satisficing, and then kind of protecting themselves with an x-ray of the elbow, which clearly isn't going to show the buckle fracture at the wrist. So that's the way we sort of go at it. However good you think your decision making is, you really do have to follow some general rules. And one of them is watch out for anchoring, watch out for search satisficing, follow the clinical rules of every discipline in medicine has its own little collection of rules and sort of red flags. And for children, the one I mentioned, the red flag you have to be careful of is examine the joint above and below. Make sure you've covered it at the two extremes. And then you're welcome to focus in on where you think the problem is. But make sure you cover yourselves, because you can be deceived by your own primitive decisions from hundreds of thousands of years ago. Search satisficing and anchoring, probably two big ones. And then there's some more subtle biases probably in play here. In the attending is in a teaching role and probably is less humble than he might otherwise be if he was practicing by himself, and then starts to bring in some of this additional noise, like this is a physician's child, and they add in that bit of noise that they tend to be over concerned about their children and complain too readily. That is putting a label on the parent, which is fairly common. They see it a lot, but you do at the same time have to trust the parent's intuition. You know, sometimes they get it completely wrong. I, not that long ago, had a young girl came in who was in playing basketball, and she got an elbow alongside her head, got an elbow against the head. And so mother brought her in to emergency and said, I'd like to get my daughter checked out. She suffered a head injury in basketball, and I'm really concerned about her. I examined the child. She seemed to be perfectly well. I couldn't find anything. I did as much of a neurological exam as you can do on a young girl. I thought, well, it's a contusion. And the mother said, well, how do we know she hasn't got a brain injury? And, you know, in the back of my mind is this other mantra about always listen to the patient. And I said, well, I accept your concerns, but I really don't find anything to support that. And she said, well, why can't we get a CAT scan to prove it, to prove that she doesn't have a brain injury? And I said, well, we could. There's no reason why we can't, other than this is an awful lot of radiation to the brain of a 14-year-old girl. And the mother said, but isn't a brain injury more important? All I'm getting at here is that the parent has a justifiable concern and wants to rule out worst case scenario. And the physician in this case is trying to back the parent away from it and say, you know, you have to take these other things into account. So those are the biases, I would say, most of them. But there may be more there. We found in our study, we looked at about 30 cases in emergency medicine in a lot of detail. And we found that whenever we had one of these cases that was noticeable enough that it warranted a close examination, that these cognitive biases often occurred together in clumps. And that typically we found about half a dozen of them in any particular case. So in your daughter's case, I'd say if you gave me a bit of time and a bit more information, I could probably come up with a couple more. But I'd say the big ones are anchoring, search satisficing, maybe some sort of hubris bias where the clinician has to demonstrate his, where he is on the authoritarian scale, the ladder for the medical student, and so on. Probably about four or five biases there.
Yeah. And I think also one more I'm thinking of as you were talking, which is confirmation bias. You know, of course, the elbow x-ray just confirms your suspicion that a nursemaid's elbow is a normal elbow x-ray. So that's confirmation bias. So I want to ask you a little bit. You've written about and thought about, especially in the fast world of emergency medicine, but actually in the current environment in medicine in so many fields, there's this issue between the way we think, this intuitive fast thinking that you've written about and spoken about versus the slower analytical thinking. And what I'd like to do with the time remaining in our conversation is starting there, think about how cognition, these different ways that we think, contribute to well-being in general, professional well-being I'm talking about. And maybe you can help create a connection or think about a connection between the well-being of the professional and how we think and this these cognitive biases and awareness of that in our work.
I think that's a very interesting corollary of this whole area is that, first of all, you know, we're talking about something for physicians that is not traditional. I mean, if you go through the medical training that I had, I don't think anybody actually mentioned the importance of clinical decision making, that it had to be taught as a science. The general rule, the general approach, I think, was that people would say, what you do is you go into the environment and you will pick this up by osmosis or something else, but you'll pick it up in a very implicit way, not explicit. So if we put you into a pediatrics residency program, you start spending time with pediatricians and you learn implicitly of ways in which you can act. I mean, what are acceptable? We don't just learn the content of pediatrics, but we learn how to behave, how to make decisions, how to behave professionally, I think is extremely important. So that's one major problem that medicine has, is we haven't really focused on the decision. I mean, there are one or two schools now in the States and in Canada that do this. They explicitly address clinical decision-making. Harvard does it, people in Cleveland, in Pittsburgh, and a couple of other places. So, but when you think about that, that's sort of remarkable that medicine would have got this far before actually thinking about how they make decisions. That itself is a major issue. But the second issue, trying to focus more onto your point about how physicians can think about themselves and their well-being in that environment, is that once you start to study medical decision-making, one of the first things you discover is that it is highly influenced by the environment in which the decision is made. I think medical people used to think they thought they were more robust than they were, that you could, for example, in my environment, you could take an emergency department, you could put 40 people in the waiting room and harassed and harried nurses running around and the chief nurse coming up to you and saying, things are really ugly out there. Can we move somebody? Can we create some space and get some flow going? Stuff like that. And so there is a relationship between the workload and also the cognitive load and how well people perform. And what we find is that most of these things are an inverted U function. If you start to increase the amount of pressure people are under, they tend to perform better and better and better. And then they reach a sort of plateau. And this is the same for cognitive load. It's the same for stress. It's the same for a few other variables. They reach a plateau. If you keep applying the pressure, then they start to decline. Their performance starts to go down. So you have to think very much about the environment in which people are working. And physicians themselves need to think about this. They need to think, what is the environment doing to me right now? There's some very interesting recent work just emerged on this called decision fatigue. And it used to be thought, like not that long ago, maybe about 10 or 15 years ago, it was thought that what happens with decision fatigue is that there is a gradual depletion of some essential nutrient, or, you know, like glucose or something else in that part of the brain that is responsible for decision making, which is mostly the prefrontal cortex. And so these arguments were circulating that maybe people were running out of glucose at a cellular level, or they were running out of something else. And that's why if you study a number of these scenarios of decision fatigue, you find that at the start of the day, people perform quite well. They're probably their optimum performance is pretty good at 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning. And as you approach noon, the quality of decision making goes down. And then if there is some sort of nutritional break at noon, it seems to be rejuvenated, and then it will decline further through the afternoon. You can show this. There's about a dozen studies show this for your willingness to give vaccines, for you to do breast exams, for you to decline giving drugs to opiate dependent people, and so on. A whole range of studies show this decision fatigue. And so people should be aware of that and the impact it's having on them. And it turns out just recently, that like within the last 2 years, great study was published showing that this decision fatigue doesn't seem to be the depletion of some essential nutrient. It seems to be instead the accumulation of some metabolite in the extracellular space in the prefrontal cortex. And it turns out that they were exactly on the money. Some stuff called glutamate, which you've probably heard of, is one of the major excitatory neurotransmitters in the brain. And they showed through some very sophisticated imaging techniques that glutamate starts to build up in the extracellular fluid space and interferes with your ability to make a decision. Now, this is proof at a cellular level. So we can tell, in fact, I'm giving a talk this week to medical students, and I'll bring up this whole glutamate theory and say, look, you have to think about what the environment is doing to you and the quality of decisions you can make. And you can say, similar phenomenon applies to increase the workload, increase the amount of stress, deprive people of nutritional breaks or threats, any kind of threat to their homeostatic state, especially loss of sleep. All of these things add up to the environment and the well-being of the people who function in it. The old adage was, physician, take care of thyself first, and it still holds, you know, and I know that some of the work that you've been doing is more sophisticated than that, but the stuff that we've looked at is fairly crude and blunt, you know, too much work, not enough sleep, too much fatigue, and all of these things translate into a compromised clinical performance.
Well, I'm really glad you mentioned the environment, because that actually is very consistent with most people's thinking about what are the drivers of physician well-being and health professional well-being. And it's really this culture of medicine, as you talked about, the systems within medicine, and that there is a role for explicitly addressing this versus assuming the implicit cultures in and subcultures within medicine is going to take care of this.
Absolutely.
Yep. I think a whole nother domain, you've written about the electronic health record as a possible, using it as a way of addressing diagnostic errors. And clearly, it seems really clear to me, and maybe not so clear to everyone, but if you're starting to use functions within the AI domain and machine learning domain, this can maybe, I'm thinking in terms of what you just shared, take away some of the drivers that are causing that buildup of the glutamate, in some ways relieving some of the cognitive load that we have so that we can continue to perform at the level that we like to perform. I'm wondering if you could just comment on the culture of medicine and what medical systems, educational and otherwise, can do to help make the discussion of errors and failures more commonplace, more normal. In fact, a vital part of the discourse among medical professionals. You've written and spoken about how departments, different areas in medicine, discuss morbidity and mortality and what they focus on. And I think these are really kind of places that we can have real practical interventions, that we don't have to wait for the glacial pace of medical culture to change, but can happen now even within our settings to help.
Yeah, I think there's some very interesting features about the medical culture that don't serve us well. When, as I said earlier, when I was a psychologist, if you got into any kind of difficulty, often the first thing you did was to share it with your supervisor or share it with a colleague or disperse the sort of cognitive load in some way. So you share it. And when I got into medicine, I noticeably missed that. There suddenly was this pressure on the individual to perform and perform to some extent in isolation without sharing the cognitive load. And I don't mean, I've got a lot on my plate here, can you help me out? I mean, just sharing the actual cognition. People don't seem to be very good at that. And that is an untapped resource, I think, in medicine. I'm working on a book with another guy in the UK right now, Mike Clancy. And we've been trying to identify some of these practices that could be changed in medicine that might lead to improved well-being of the individual physician, but importantly, too, improve performance. So sharing, distributing the cognition, the idea is already there in the literature and it can be exploited. We need to accept that somebody else's thinking is often a good component of your thinking. And that isn't shifting the responsibility or trying to diminish the amount of work that you're doing, but simply bringing in the help from outside. That was one issue. Another one that comes to mind when you were talking about this was medicine is a hugely balkanized business. I mean, it's split up into all these little factions, and both within disciplines and between disciplines. So you have intra and interdisciplinary issues, and you have all these sort of built-in authority gradients and so on that interfere with people being willing to express their thoughts. And like in this case, the medical student, your case, the medical student may well have had some ideas about what else might be going on, but was not willing to share them because of the dominance of the authoritarian figure and so on. So those are a couple: distributed cognition, trying to tap into the authority gradients. I think the other thing too is, although it has been admirable in some respects in medicine, there has been a sort of, we have had a kind of heroic kind of, I don't know what you would call it, but some sort of, I'm reminded of a physician who they were talking about their careers and how well they'd spent their careers, and a physician gravestone they mentioned where it said, he cared everything for his patients. And there was nothing there about, but he completely disregarded his family in the process. But I think I see less of it now, I think, as I get older. there was this kind of heroic component to physician performance that I must keep going, even though I'm beginning to act a bit stupid, you know. But when I was an intern, we did 36-hour rotation. I mean, that is heroic, but it's stupid. It's absolutely stupid. And there were times, I told my son, who's just gone into medicine, told him once about a situation where I was running an arrest and I fell asleep. I mean, I just had not had any sleep for about 36 hours. I was going through a routine, you know, do this, then do this, then do this. I did the critical things. I got the patient intubated and then we got some lines started and so on. And everybody knew what the routine was. But I just fell asleep and fell across the patient's legs. I mean, that is so stupid. And yet that was going on everywhere. And I'm sure a lot of that has changed. But that is something else about, I mean, if you add up all these insults to physician homeostasis that go on, not taking reasonable nutrition breaks, not taking work breaks, not getting enough sleep, working at high pressures, and so on. If you add enough of them up and the effects that they have on the physician, then eventually you can be looking at burnout. And burnout is very real. I've seen a couple of colleagues go through it, and it was too close for comfort. But these were very hardworking, sacrificial people who did everything they could for medicine and did nothing for themselves. And it's all very heroic, but once it happens, you've actually lost somebody in the process. So,
well, I really appreciate you discussing all these parts. This is a really a nice way to segue toward a close. You know, you started off telling us about the sea surgeon or the sea, whatever it was called, in Kent, in the southeast of England, along the coast there, and how that heroism, in a sense, drew you in, and then realizing that it's, you know, quite a bit more complex than that, and one can actually lose the important qualities of our life in the process of giving so much, in a sense, in that way. And I think I wanted to kind of close in two ways. One, as I'm thinking about what we've discussed with cognition, I'm thinking about our genus and species. You know, we've given ourselves the name Homo sapiens sapiens. We've given ourselves two doses of our species. And my understanding of the roots of that has to do with awareness or thinking. We are the species of the genus Homo that knows through our senses, through our cognition, through our awareness. And why do we give ourselves that second sapiens name? Because we know that we know. So built in, we know that we think. We think about thinking, unlike what we assume other species do or don't do. So we can actually think about what it would be like to have a life that is of service, but also at the same time takes care of ourselves so that we can be of service to ourselves and to others and to our family. So I did want you to reflect on that piece and also share with us, what do you do for enjoyment and fun? You shared with us before we started the podcast about being out and hiking, et cetera. But fun is being connected in some way with actually keeping yourself and keeping us all healthy enough to mitigate those cognitive biases, distortions, and errors. So there you go. We'll finish with that. It's an open field for those reflections.
Well, my wife is a little bit critical of me there and says that I still have remnants of this, you know, I've got to work hard stuff. And she's right. I'm still working on another book, which is my fourth or fifth. And I think she's kind of gently pointing out that I'm getting a bit old for this and maybe I ought to spend a bit more time. So I deliberately now seek out things that fall into that sort of well-being domain. What can I do to sort of make myself less of a hero and less of a slave and more of I don't have any family around anymore. They've all left except my good wife. But I deliberately try to cultivate interesting things that might interest her that we could share together and I could do for myself. I think it requires a bit of effort after you step out of the race that you've been in for about 40 years and you suddenly say, now I'm on my own. And what can I do to sort of improved my reflection and my sense of perspective on what I've done. And I think it's part of, somebody should write a good book, they probably have, about how to grow old properly. I'm sure I'm not doing it right, but there's probably somebody out there, and they've probably done that. It's just I haven't found the time to look for the books yet, but they're probably out there. I think you're absolutely right. We do need to engage that sort of post-physician phase where we're saying, okay, now what? I don't really want people to put on my gravestone that I really took care of my patients. I'd prefer they mention my family too, somewhere in there.
Lovely. Well, thank you. This has been just completely enjoyable.
Thank you so much for listening. We will include a summary of today's podcast and links about Dr. Cross-Carey and other references discussed in the show notes. I'd like to conclude by sharing another practical exercise to help you flourish. Because of the work that Dr. Cross-Carey does in thinking about how we think, today's home practice relates directly to that. So I'd like you to just sit as you're listening to this, however you're sitting or standing, and just settling into an awareness of your body. One way to do that is to just bring awareness to the breathing, the sensations of breathing. And as you do that, perhaps becoming also aware of how you're feeling. Feeling in terms of feeling okay, or this is uncomfortable, or I like this moment, or I don't like this moment. It doesn't really matter. Just noticing how you are actually feeling and relating to this moment emotionally. And then you may notice, with a pause, which I'll give you a 5 to 10 second pause here, that there will be some thoughts, perfectly natural. Perhaps noticing, if you can, these thoughts as simply events, things that are happening that your mind is doing. You don't have to believe or agree or disagree with the thoughts, simply noticing them. One option is to just say to yourself, oh, thinking, I'm thinking. And that's the practice. That's it. You can do this from time to time to bring awareness to the thinking mind, doing what it always does, thinks. No need to change it, no need to direct it, no need to feel bad about it or good about it. Just awareness to it. Simply practice the awareness of thoughts. And perhaps as you do this, as it becomes part of your regular activities, you may begin to link how one thought leads to another, and eventually to deconstruct how a decision is made. Eventually, we can trace where these cognitions help and where they may derail our decision-making process. I hope you found this podcast and this very simple exercise useful to you, and look forward to having you join us for the next episode of Flourishing in Medicine, From Surviving to Thriving. For more about MPRO, please visit www.mympro.com or www.mympro.com/peer-support for a variety of their peer support programs. If you are in need of urgent support as a physician or medical student, please consider calling the physician support line at 1-888-409-0141 or visiting www.physiciansupportline.com. And for more information about me and my work, please visit www.mickkrasnermd.com or www.mindfulpracticeinmedicine.com. I hope to have you listen to our next episode. Until then,